he probably agrees with most of what I'm going to say, not least because he's the co-author of the paper on which this talk is based. It's not on any archive, but if you want a draft, you can email either of us. So Wayne was trying to convince you that there's a problem, or a prima facie problem, that ever Etienne should take seriously. This is the evidential problem. And I want to tell you what we think is the solution to this problem. So in particular, I agree with the following. This is from Wayne's conclusion slide. The evidential problem is one that ever Etienne should take seriously. And here's what we need in order to have a solution to this problem. We need either a way of making sense of talk of probability in an Everettian multiverse, or if we haven't got that, then we need some surrogate for probability talk. And it has to be a surrogate on which observed relative frequencies that closely match Born rule chances still count as evidence in favor of the theory. Furthermore, this has to be achieved in a way that doesn't presuppose the correctness of quantum mechanics, Everettian or otherwise. Otherwise, we have this threat of a reductio ad Kuhn type worry. And the worry is that if you can't come up with this sort of thing, then you're in the funny sort of situation of having a theory, Everettian quantum mechanics, that's internally coherent and consistent with all of your experience. So if you'd come to believe it, somehow everything would be fine. But the worry is that there's no way that you can have any empirical justification for coming to believe it in the first place. Good. Okay. So before I say how I think we can solve this problem, I want to make just a few preliminary remarks to locate the program that I'll be talking about within the context of a few distinctions that have been made already at this conference and that I think are very useful when talking about probability in Everett. So here's the first preliminary remark. Rather than just talking about the problem of probability in Everett, it's useful to distinguish the incoherence problem from the quantitative problem. These two problems have a very different character from one another. The incoherence problem is a conceptual problem. This is the very basic worry that since you've got a theory that just says everything that you previously thought was a possible outcome of the experiment is definitely going to happen on some branch or other, it no longer seems to make sense to talk of probabilities at all, Born rule ones or otherwise. That's the problem that I'm mostly going to be talking about. The other problem is the quantitative problem. This one presupposes that we've somehow solved the incoherence problem and then says, okay, if we're going to talk about probabilities somehow, if we somehow worked out what that might mean, there's still a further question of which numbers the probabilities ought to be in an Everettian theory. And I take this to be primarily the problem that the Deutsch-Wallace argument is focusing on. Second preliminary remark. This is about the distinction between subjective uncertainty and objective determinism that came up, for example, in Adrian Kent's talk. There are two ways you might go about trying to either make sense of probability talk or do without it in Everett. Which route you try to take depends on what you think is the answer to the following question. The question is, does this make sense? Imagine that you're an Everettian and you're about to perform a spin measurement on a non-trivial superposition of spin up and spin down. Since you're an Everettian, you think that what's going to happen when you perform this measurement is the universe is going to split, here's the splitting, there's going to be this spin up branch, and there's going to be this spin down branch. But crucially, the measurement hasn't happened yet. This splitting event is in the future. This means that you can't ask, what's the result on the branch that I'm on? You're not on either of them yet, or if you're on either, perhaps you're on both. So if that you now, before the measurement, say the outcome spin up may or may not occur, you might have a worry about whether or not that makes sense. If you think it does make sense, then you can go with a subjective uncertainty program that's been perceived mostly by Simon Saunders and David Wallace. But many people, including my former self and Wayne's former self, and lots of people at this conference, think that that doesn't make sense. If it doesn't make sense, then it's harder to make sense of probability talk in Everett. And then you'll want to go with something more like the objective determinism program, or sometimes called the Fission program. In this talk, I'm going to be presupposing for the sake of argument that sentences like this don't make sense if uttered before the measurement, so I'll be working within the Fission program. Last preliminary remark, practical and evidential problems. This is the one that's crucial to the main topic of the talk. Why can't we do without probability altogether as Everettians? Why can't we just say we've got a theory that postulates all these branches and says they're all going to be real? There seem to be two reasons we can't just do without probability. The first one is that if you do that, then you have no idea how you ought to make practical decisions insofar as you believe this theory. But the second problem, and the one that I want to talk about, is this epistemic or evidential problem. I use the words interchangeably. And this is the issue of why you should believe every Etienne quantum mechanics in the first place. Okay, so what is that, this problem? Wayne said it out very nicely, so I'll just quickly review it. Here's the worry. We take it that we know, we have a pretty good idea how evidence bears on the truth of probabilistic or chancy theories. We take it that something like the following confirmation theoretic principle is true, this principle that I call CC, confirmation theoretic role of chances. If my theory assigned high chance to some outcome X of some particular experiment, and if rival theories assigned lower chance to X, then if outcome X occurs, that's going to confirm my theory relative to those rivals. I take it that's utterly mundane. Everyone believes it. We all take it that this is something we know about confirmation theory, even if we're not sure how the details of that confirmation theory will work out. Given that we've got that principle, everything is fine for a chancy version of quantum mechanics, such as, say, a dynamical collapse model. Quantum mechanics, under such an interpretation, is a chance theory, and then it has masses of evidence in its support from relative frequency data and so forth. But the worry is, at least if you reject this subjective uncertainty program, that a many-worlds version of quantum mechanics doesn't seem to be a chance theory. There don't seem to be any spaces for chances in this theory. It is, after all, a deterministic theory with no ignorance of initial conditions. It just says that everything's going to happen on some branch. And in that case, it's not clear how the sort of evidence we have, relative frequencies and so forth, is going to bear on the truth of the theory. I emphasize not clear. This is important. In discussing the evidential problem, one sometimes talks as though the situation is the following. We already have our confirmation theory. We all know how it works. And it has the consequence that evidence doesn't confirm Everettian quantum mechanics. So much the worse for Everettian quantum mechanics. But that's not the situation that we're in. And this came out nicely in David Albert's talk. If you think through what happens when you carry out the most naive application of a principle like this to an Everettian theory, you don't get the result that nothing confirms Everettian quantum mechanics. You get the result that everything confirms Everettian quantum mechanics, because this is a theory that assigned chance one to everything. So what that seems to show is not that we know how confirmation works and it's bad news for Everett. Rather, what it seems to show is that something is really seriously wrong with confirmation theory as that naive understanding of it has things go. We've got a crisis in our confirmation theory. We don't know what to do when branching theories are among the ones that we're contemplating. And we need to work out how the confirmation theory should go. Okay. So that's what I want to try and do. I want to write down a confirmation theory that can deal with the possibility that the universe might be branching and that will then tell us what the relationship is between relative frequencies and Everettian quantum mechanics. Is it confirmed? Is it disconfirmed? Does it bear no non-trivial confirmation relation at all to a theory? Or what's the story? Things are going to be good for the Everettian if we end up with the following principle, and of course I'm going to be arguing that we do. I call this one CW, confirmation theoretic role of branch weight. So think of Everettian quantum mechanics as a theory that assigns branch weights to outcomes rather than chances to outcomes. Here's the principle, or the candidate principle. If my theory assigned high branch weight to some outcome X, and if rival theories assigned low branch weight to X, then X confirms my theory relative to those rivals. Straightforward to see that if we have this principle, then things are going to be just as good for the Everettian theory, evidence-wise, as they are for other versions of quantum mechanics. But you might have this worry that this principle is unmotivated or ad hoc or mad or similar. It's an interesting question what our reaction ought to be if we couldn't think of any independent justification for this principle. You might take the attitude that, look, there's nothing better on the table. We don't know how to get by without any principle at all, so we can give some sort of total theory justification of it. But then on the other hand, you might have the sort of worry that David Wallace and Simon Saunders mentioned briefly in their talks, that we really want to minimize, as far as we possibly can, appeals to otherwise unjustified assumptions when we're justifying Everettian quantum mechanics. It would be much nicer if any principle we needed to invoke just dropped out of things that we were already committed to. So I don't want to just postulate this principle or give it a total theory justification. Rather, the strategy is going to be revisit the reasons we had from confirmation theory for thinking that the chance principle CC was true in the first place, and then argue that those things that we were already committed to are going to entail this principle that solves the Everettian evidential problem in a way favorable to Everettian quantum mechanics. Good, okay, so that was the preamble. So if I have a chance theory, what can I draw? The idea is just this. If I have a chance theory, I can say, okay, here are two possible outcomes, spin up, spin down. One of them's going to be real, and I don't know which. And when I write numbers like mod A squared and mod B squared on the branches, those give the chances of the outcomes. The thought is, in the Everettian case, you still get these trees, but now all of the branches are real. You still got the numbers, but now you can't call them chances. So let's think of a new name for them. Okay, they're branch weights. Yeah, and I'm changing one label for another because lots of people object to the use of the label chance in the Everettian case because they think it doesn't make sense, and I need something to call them because I want to talk about them. But we know how to get them from the theory. The amplitudes are there in the theory. They're complex numbers. You take their modulus, you square it. That's just unproblematic. Okay, we're going to have to leave that one for later. Okay, so here's the plan. So that we can go beyond brute appeal to intuition, that is, so that we can go beyond just saying our principle CC looks really plausible intuitively and this crazy principle CW looks really crazy intuitively, I want to go back and look at the foundations for the principle CC. I take these foundations to be Bayesian ones, as does Wayne, and I also subscribe to the remarks Wayne made about Bayesianism not necessarily entailing all of the things that all of the people who call themselves Bayesians take it to entail. In particular, I'm not going to be committed to any claim that the wave function is about states of knowledge or that there's no such thing as objective chance. I'll tell you what I mean by Bayesianism. I will, however, be talking explicitly about rational agents and decision theory. So I want to make a few remarks about that, because this is sometimes taken to be an objection to the whole Deutsch-Wallace decision theory type approach to probability and Everett. And I don't think it should be taken as an objection. So here's an example of a quote from somebody who does take it as an objection. Richard Gill, in a 2005 paper, is commenting on Deutsch's decision theoretic derivation of Everettian probabilities. And he says he doesn't like the following thing about Deutsch's paper. We do not accept that the behavior of a rational decision maker should play a role in modeling physical systems. And Gill takes this to be motivation for the project he then goes on to engage in, which is trying to reconstruct Deutsch's axioms as being about relative frequencies rather than being about rational decision making, because he wants to be a frequentist about probability. Now, I have a certain amount of sympathy with the sentiment that underlies this, but I think it's a mistake to take this as an objection to talking about rationality in the present context. And let me say something about why. What's the character of our problem? The character of our problem is a crisis in confirmation theory. We have a physical theory that ascribes amplitude squares to branches. And our worry is that we don't know whether or not it's rational to believe that theory. So the worry we have, the problem that we're trying to solve, is a problem about the relationship between physical theory on the one hand and rationality on the other. Given that that's our question, it shouldn't be a surprise that in answering the question, we need to think just as hard about the theory of rationality as we do about physics. So that's my reason for thinking that in talking about agency and so forth, I'm not doing anything that a hard-nosed scientist who wants to arrive at the objective description of physical reality should object to. Yeah.
Let's say we knew so many people in the world in 3 minutes. So the principle by which we make rational decisions about the is totally irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Are you saying then the argument for whether we believe an Everettian account of our past observations totally changed because there is no really what they rely on our principles by making the decisions?
No, I'm not saying that.
Hopefully you'll explain my answer.
Good. Okay, so I'll go through these foundations, and this will be a review of Bayesian decision theory and Bayesian confirmation theory. Secondly, I want to argue that when you think about how the possibility that the world might be branching fits into this framework, you will see that the same foundations support the confirmation theoretic principle that the Everettian needs, the one that I call CW in the branching case. And finally, not entirely a trivial step from 2 to 3, I'll argue that this is enough. This solves the evidential problem that we were worried about. Okay. So Bayesian foundations of CC with a small b. First, I'll sketch a framework. Then within this framework, I'll state the Savage axioms and the representation theorem you can get from those concerning maximization of expected utility. Then in section C, I want to forge the link between maximization of expected utility and learning. So this is where the link between practical decision making and epistemology and confirmation theory comes in. So far, so good. At this point, we still won't have said anything about objective chances, and we won't have said anything that in the Everettian case allowed us to talk about branch weights. So that's the purpose of section D. I'll talk about exchangeability, the Definetti representation theorem, and how this can be construed as telling us that rational agents have beliefs about chances, but this is the same thing that Wayne already said, so I can be quite brief there. And then finally, I'll just remark that this allows us to recover the confirmation theoretic principle that we started with. Okay, so here's the framework. You have a set of experiments, token experiments. So this coin flip will be one particular experiment. If I flip the coin twice, that's two experiments. For every experiment, you have a set, call it SA, of outcomes. And we're going to be dealing with finite partitions of the outcome spaces of these experiments. So for example, if the experiment is a coin flip, then a particularly salient partition, although by no means the only one, is the partition into the coin landed heads and the coin landed tails. Then we have a set of the set P of payoffs. So the payoffs are the sorts of things that agents care about, like receiving $10 or going on a beach holiday or being tortured. And we have a set W of wagers. Notation. So a wager is something that assigns payoffs to each member of a partition of the outcome space of some experiment, the experiment that it's a wager on. And the notation is, if I write H goes to $100 and T goes to -$50, that means what you think it is, what you think it means, that's the wager where if the coin lands heads, you get $100, and if the coin lands tails, you lose $50. And we assume that any assignment of payoffs to finite partitions of outcome spaces is a wager in the set that we're dealing with. Say again? Probably no, but tell me what you mean. Independent in what sense? They can. They can be dependent in a stronger sense as well. For example, one experiment might be crush the die underfoot and see what shape the splodge makes, and the other one might be roll the die a minute later. Those aren't very independent either. Okay. So the Savage theorem is relatively familiar. I've written the axioms out on the handout. The reason that I've done that is that this is going to be another one of those talks where people raise objections, and the answer is, if you don't like it, tell me which axiom you don't agree with. So if that's just the game I'm going to be playing, I thought it would be fair to give you a copy of the axioms written out in full rather than in the fluffier versions that I'm likely to put up on slides. But these are just the standard Savage axioms. From these axioms, you can prove that any preference ordering that obeys all of the axioms has a maximization of expected utility representation. That is, there exists a utility function, little u, on the set of payoffs, real-valued function. And there exists a function, alpha, satisfying the Kolmogorov axioms, as it happens, on subsets of experimental outcome spaces. And these recover the original preference ordering that we started with in the following sense. For any two wagers, f and g, g is going to be weakly preferred to f if and only if v of g is greater than or equal to v of f, where V is defined as follows, it's expected utility intuitively. For any wager on an experiment A, if DI gives the partition of the outcome space of A, and little ai are possible payoffs, if F is the wager that assigns AI to each possible outcome DI, then the value of this wager is given by the sum over the elements of the partition of the alpha values of those partition elements multiplied by the utilities of the associated payoffs. So intuitively, these are credences. And if you are unhappy, if you are squeamish about the notion of subjective credence, the idea is you should now be happy, because we've defined it operationally in terms of things that you should have been happy with in the first place, namely preferences over wages. The agent is acting as if this is her credence function, and you as her utility function, and she's maximizing expected utility. Okay, so now we have a situation where, well, insofar as agents are just going around making practical decisions, that is, deciding which wages to accept and reject, they're maximizing expected utility with respect to some credence function. But that's a purely synchronic statement, and we want to forge a connection with confirmation theory. So we need to say what this has to do with learning. What does it have to do with epistemology? And it turns out that when we laid down the Savage axioms, we've already said enough to entail something very close to the following statement. The agent will always update by conditionalization. So the claim is this preference ordering that we've already laid down on wages is going to induce a preference ordering on belief upstating strategies, and given the Savage axioms, it's going to be conditionalization. We need conditionalization because this is part of the Bayesian foundation of the principle I want to recover, the confirmation theoretic role of chances. If you don't update by conditionalization, then there are all kinds of crazy evidential relationships there might be between relative frequencies and theories, including lots that we don't want. Okay, so consider the following situation. I walk into the room with a die that you've never seen before, and I ask you to choose between the following two bets. You win $100 if the die lands one, or you win $100 if the die lands six. Well, if you know me at all, or in fact, if you don't know me at all, you're likely to be a bit suspicious of this sort of suggestion, and you're likely to think that it would be a great advantage to you if, rather than deciding right away which of those two bets you accept, you first get to roll the die once or twice, or say 100 times. So what we want to do next is capture in our framework this sort of phenomenon. Why is it advantageous to experiment first, and how exactly does that help you to choose between wages? To do this, introduce the notion of a combined experiment. So for any two experiments that are compatible, in the sense that they're not like the two I described to Rudiger, they're not ones, one of which precludes the performance of the other. There's going to be a third experiment. So if A and B are compatible experiments, write C equals A plus B for the combined experiment. This just means perform the first and then perform the second. And this, of course, has outcome space given by the Cartesian product of the outcome space of experiment A and the outcome space of experiment B. And then require the set of experiments we're dealing with to be closed under this combination operation. How does that help? Well, now we can do the following thing. Suppose that we have two compatible experiments, A and B. Suppose that A is going to be performed before B. Suppose that we've picked some salient n-element partition of the outcome space of the first experiment. And now we're considering two possible wages, F and G, on the outcome of the second experiment. And you have to choose, do you prefer F or G? And you have the option of, rather than deciding right away, making this choice after observing the outcome of A. This is going to be a good thing to do in general. So what you're really choosing is not, do I go for wager F or do I go for wager G? Rather, what you're choosing is an assignment of F or G to each of the possible outcomes of A. So you can specify in advance, which of these two will I choose if experiment A has outcome number one? Which of these two will I choose if experiment A has outcome number two? And so forth. Call such a specification an updating strategy. This is a choice of wager on the combined experiment. So here's the point. Since we specified that the original set of experiments was closed under the combination operation, when we wrote down your preference ordering on the set of wagers on all such experiments, we've already written down enough information to specify your preference ordering on updating strategies like this, right? If updating strategies are just wages on combined experiments, and if all wages on combined experiments are in the sets that we already know your preference ordering on, then we already know your preferences between updating strategies. And it turns out to be possible to prove the following thing. If your preferences obey the Savage axioms, at the bottom here now, if your preferences obey the Savage axioms, and if alpha is the credence function that currently represents your preferences between wages, then your current preferences strictly prefer updating by conditionalization to any other updating strategy. What do I mean by updating by conditionalization in this context? I mean the following thing. You already know that at the later time also, your preferences for wages on experiments that haven't yet been performed will still satisfy the Savage axioms. So you already know now that at the later time, your preferences will be represented by some credence function. But it's not necessarily the same credence function that represents your preferences now. If we write little alpha I for the preference for the credence function that represents the preferences that you will have after updating your preferences among wages on the observation that the ith outcome occurred to experiment A, and if we define conditionalization in the usual way, so alpha I assigns to the jth outcome of experiment B the number that you get by dividing this, the alpha value of the intersection of the ith outcome of first experiment and the jth outcome of the second experiment by the alpha value of the ith outcome of the first experiment, then this defines conditionalization, this defines all the alpha i's, and this turns out to be the preferred updating strategy. So, okay, there are lots of other justifications for conditionalization you might give, but this is one of them. Does that show that rational agents update by conditionalization? Well, not quite, but it's a fairly pedantic objection. The objection might be the following. This just shows that rational agents now prefer that they later update by conditionalization. It doesn't show that they actually go ahead and do it. So we need an axiom that says they actually go ahead and do what they earlier wanted themselves to do. And that's what our intertemporal consistency axiom tells us. So now we have the result that any agent whose preferences among wages satisfy the Savage axioms, and who in addition satisfies P7 updates by conditionalization. Good. Now we're almost there. The last thing we need, and this is going to be the bit that gets us to talk about chances, is the DeFinetti representation theorem. How much time do I have? We're about 20 minutes. Okay, good. Okay, so I'll be brief here. Partly because it's been explained before. DeFinetti representation. If we're going to be able to do science at all, it had better be the case that there are some sequences of experiments that we get to regard as repeatable. This is captured in the Bayesian framework by the concept of exchangeability. So here's the definition. If you've got a sequence of mutually compatible experiments, and they're copies of the same experiment in some sense, so they have isomorphic outcome spaces, if it's the case that for any wager on the outcomes of a finite subset of this sequence, the value of the wager isn't changed if the payoffs attached to any two elements of the sequence are switched, then we say that the sequence is exchangeable. So a sequence might be exchangeable relative to the preferences of some agent. This doesn't rule out the fact that the agent might regard the outcome of the first experiment as relative to her choice of wager on the second experiment. Then you can prove from the same axioms that we already have the following thing. I'm going to have to skip the details. But the basic idea is, as has already been described, if you've got an exchangeable sequence, then you can represent the agent's credence function as a mixture of chance functions, in the sense that the chance functions are things that assign the same probability to every element of the sequence. So you can decompose the agent's credence function in this sort of way. And in that case, you have an agent whose credences are at least as if she believes that there are objective chances satisfying the principal principle, and she has credences about the values of these chances, and she's maximizing expected utility with respect to the credence average of the possible chance distributions. Good. Okay, so now we're almost there. Now we can get the things that we already knew were true back from our Bayesian framework, and this counts as evidence in favor of our Bayesian framework. For example, consider a long run of coin tosses. If you satisfy the Savage axioms, then you have a prior credence function about the outcomes of this long run of coin tosses. You might start out uncertain about what the chance of heads on a single toss is, so the DeFinetti representation theorem shows that you have some mu function if you start out uncertain about what the chances are, this is going to appear as the fact that your mu function starts out relatively flat, so perhaps the chance of heads is 2/3, perhaps it's 1/3, perhaps it's something else you don't know. If you observe a long run of outcomes and say it's a long run of outcomes in which heads comes up approximately 2/3 of the time, and if you conditionalize on this string of outcomes because you obey our axiom P7, then the result is going to be, just delivered by the mathematics, the mu function at the later time is going to become sharply peaked, close to lambda equals 2/3. So at least insofar as preferences among wages are concerned, what's happened is you've become more confident than you originally were that the chance is something close to 2/3 as a result of updating on relative frequency evidence. In other words, exactly the sort of thing that we knew ought to happen does happen in this framework. Good. Exchangeability.
Exchangeability restricts the form of the truck, right? So it's an assumption of power for the distribution. So would that annoy this?
Well, it's an assumption about the preference ordering on wages. So yeah, it's implicitly an assumption about the credence distribution.
Okay.
And similarly, you get the confirmation theoretic principle back. If you know that relative frequencies can make you more confident that the chance of heads is 2/3, then if my theory said the chance of heads is 2/3, and your theory said it's nothing like 2/3, then that relative frequency evidence is going to confirm my theory, and it's going to disconfirm yours. Okay, fine. What does that have to do with the average interpretation? What I want to argue is that if you're thinking of experiments as things that lead to branching rather than things that lead to indeterminism, all of the axioms that we've written down, the Savage axioms, of P7 and P8, still apply. They don't lose any plausibility in this process. And I want to argue for a particular application of those axioms to the branching case, the application that delivers the result that the other axiom wants. So the first observation is that decisions still make sense. If you're an Everettian, then wages become things that realize some tree with different rewards on different branches, and you can ask which tree you prefer. I know what I'd choose in this case, for example. And then there are two ways you can apply the framework to decisions in this branching context. I call them application number one and application number two. Application number one, I think, is what you had in mind this morning, although I'm not 100% sure. This application of decision theory leads to the result that there's really very little you can say about preferences among branching wages. You take the attitude that an experiment only has one outcome, namely the whole tree, that a payoff should now, in the Everettian context, be regarded as the whole assignment of monetary rewards and so forth to branches. And if you're thinking that way, then the natural conclusion is that in the branching case, the only rationality constraints we have are transitivity and completeness. The thought being, look, this is a case of decision-making under conditions of certainty. You know, if you're an Everettian, which branching tree, if complete with rich rewards of which branches, will result from any so-called wager that you choose to go for. And the theory of decision-making under conditions of certainty, so the thought goes, is trivial. That leads to disaster for the Everettian. It has the result that there just aren't any constraints, and we don't know what's going to happen, and we haven't solved the branching theory.
So what is
completeness? Your preferences have to be a complete order. It's just an axiom of extended order. But I think we can say a lot more. I think that we don't have to rest with just this very weak decision theory that says the only constraints are transitivity and completeness. I think that the other constraints that we have, dominance and sure thing and so forth, remain just as plausible under a different application to the branching situation as they were in any case under the application to conditions of uncertainty. So let me try briefly to convince you of that. Transitivity, okay, this is boring, we all know our preferences, so I have to be transitive. Here's a more interesting case. Consider the dominance axiom. So this is going to be a non-trivial application of a dominance axiom to decision making under conditions of branching. Suppose that we ascertain by looking at trivial wages, that is, wages on which you get the same reward on all branches, that you prefer receiving $1,000 on all branches to losing $5 on all branches. So presumably that's because you think that getting $1,000 is better than losing $5. Good, we've ascertained that. And then we offer you a choice between the following two wagers. Wager J is one where there's going to be a stone Gerlach experiment, two branches, spin up and spin down. On the spin up branch, you're going to win $1,000. On the spin down branch, you're going to lose $5. Wager K is a wager on the same experiment, but with different assignments and payoffs. This is a wager where you're going to get $1,000 on both branches. I take it it's rather obvious that, given that you've already told us you prefer $1,000 to -5, you should at least not prefer wager J to wager K. It's hard to know what to say to people who want to argue with this, but then it's hard to know what to say to people who want to argue with the decision theoretic axioms in the uncertainty application too. Insofar as there is anything to say, it seems to be something like this. So this is back in the forgetting everything quantum mechanics, back in the Chalmers case. Here's why I believe the dominance axiom. Those two wagers I just described, J and K, they're wagers that give me the same reward if spin up occurs, and K is a wager that gives me a better reward than does J if spin down occurs. So in choosing K over J, I can't lose and I might gain. Sounds pretty reasonable. But I think the following thing sounds equally reasonable in the branching case, and this is the point. If the world is branching, then these two wagers give me the same reward on the spin-up branch, and K gives me a better reward than does J on the spin-down branch. So in choosing K over J, I won't lose on any branch, and I'll win and I'll gain on some branch. I take it this is no less plausible than that. If you agree, then you think that at least for the case of this particular axiom, the non-trivial application of decision theory to branching that I'm advocating is no less plausible than the usual application of decision theory to case of decision making under uncertainty. And then the game is going to be, okay, repeat. I've done this for one axiom. Let's look at the others. Let's look at the sure thing axiom. Let's look at the non-triviality axiom. I don't have time to go through all of them, but I've written that for you here. If anyone thinks that any is less plausible under a branching application than under an uncertainty application, then I didn't hear about it. I'm not aware of any compelling reasons for thinking they're not, or any missing reasons. Okay, so what happens if you accept all that? Suppose for the sake of argument that you have accepted the branching application of all of these decision theoretic axioms. Then what follows? Well, none of the mathematics has changed. People have already proved for us several theorems. We have a Savage theorem telling us that any preference ordering that obeys Savage's axioms leads to a maximization of expected utility representation. We have a conditionalization formula for the alpha functions that appear in the Savage representation. And we also have a DiFinetti representation to decompose the alpha functions in terms of chance distributions. None of that's going to change. What is going to change, if you're moving from an indeterministic theory to a chance theory, is how you think conceptually about these mathematical quantities, for example, these alpha functions. What changes? Well, this is related to the reasons we had for being worried about probability and Everett in the first place. What we were getting at when we rejected subjective uncertainty was the thought that if I'm here before the split, it doesn't make sense for me to say things like spin up might occur and might not occur. But if we think that, so if we're in the Fission program at all, we're also going to think that once you've got this alpha function that assigns numbers, I don't know, alpha 1 and alpha 2, say, to branches, it's not going to make sense to call them credences. You can't have a non-trivial credence now that spin-up will occur or that you will be on the spin-up branch or anything of the sort. So we've still got an alpha function. It's something that puts numbers on branches, but we're no longer allowed to think of the alpha function as a credence function. This just means that we need to invent some new terminology so that we can talk about the alpha function without using the offensive terminology of credence. So elsewhere I've suggested that caring measure might be an appropriate term for the alpha function in the branch context. The thought here being, look, if these numbers are unequal, if your decision theoretic measure is assigning a higher number to the spin-up branch and the spin-down branch, that's having the consequence that you prefer to receive a given reward on the spin-up branch and the spin-down branch. And why might that possibly be? Well, one reason would be you think it's more important to you what happens on the spin-up branch than what happens on the spin-down branch. That is, you care more about what goes on spin-up and spin-down. So for that sort of reason, you might think that caring measuring is an appropriate term. If for any reason you don't like that one, pick something utterly neutral, like quasi-credence, so something that behaves decision theoretically like credence, but isn't credence. Similarly for chances and branch works, we already talked about this. there are these numbers in the definitive representation, alpha sub lambda. There can't be chances because we're rejecting subjective uncertainty. But they've got to be something, so let's call them branch weights. And then the picture that emerges is something like this. For an agent whose preference ordering satisfies all of the Savage axioms, this agent's preferences are as if she's maximizing expected utility. According to this measure, alpha, call it caring measure or quasi-credence or what you will, that quantifies or seems to quantify how much she cares about what happens on each branch. This measure, in turn, is determined by her degrees of belief about what the branch weights are for each possible experiment. She treats these branch rates as giving the objective relative importances of the branches, at least insofar as practical decision making is concerned. And as before, when you update this alpha function by the preferred strategy, the one that the theorem tells you is preferred by the agent's preference ordering, this is going to have the consequence that relative frequency data boosts credence, and here I do mean credence, that the actual branch rates approximately match the observed relative frequencies. In consequence, it's going to follow, as CC followed from the usual Bayesian framework, that the confirmation theoretic principle CW is true. Observing events that a branch in theory postulates with high weights is going to boost credence in that theory. Okay, an example to attempt to make that a bit more intuitive. You've got a coin, it's about to be flipped 100 times. This is a combined experiment. You have preferences for wages on the combined experiment, and let's suppose that your preferences treat the sequence of flips as exchangeable. Suppose further that your alpha function assigns its coefficients significantly above zero, only to alpha 1/3 and alpha 2/3. So these are the chance distributions, sorry, the branch weight distributions that say the branch weight of heads is 1/3 and the branch weight of heads is 2/3. If you observe the first 50 flips and 15 of them come up heads, and if you update on this observation by conditionalization, then the result is going to be that you become more confident that the branch weight of heads is 1/3. Just as in the chance case, you would have become more confident that the chance of heads is 2/3.
Don't you mean the reverse?
Possibly.
No?
No, I don't think so. 15 out of 50, right? You know, roughly 1/3, you would say.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay. Why is the carrying
Because I replaced it with alpha function.
I'm sorry.
So it could be.
So the recurring measure, right? Okay, sorry.
But this might seem counterintuitive, and I want to try and persuade you that it's not. Why does it make good sense to update your degrees of belief in this way? Well, think about it again from the perspective of the pre-branching agent. She thinks there are going to be these future branches. She's not sure what the branch rates are. She thinks that either the heads branches have twice the weight of the tails branches, or vice versa. So in consequence, she either thinks that the branch weight on which the relative frequency of heads is approximately 1/3. She either thinks that those branches have high total branch weight or that they have low total branch weight. And similarly for the relative frequency 2/3. And she's got to pick some updating strategy. She knows that on each branch she's going to see some relative frequency of heads. And she has to update her degrees of belief in branch weights in response to this information somehow. It would be very nice if she could adopt an updating policy that said, well, you know, in those possible worlds where it's heads that has the higher branch weight, I'll jump to degree of belief one, that heads has the higher branch weight, and in those possible worlds in which tails has the higher branch weight, I'll jump to degree of belief one, that tails has the higher branch weight. But that's not an updating strategy that's available to her. The only thing that she has to respond to, the only thing on which her later credences can functionally depend, is the relative frequency on a branch. So given that constraint, it's hard to see how she can do any better. She knows that whatever updating policy she picks, she's going to end up with bad degrees of belief that are wrong about the actual branch rates on some branches. So it seems that the best she can do is pick some updating strategy according to which the total weight of the branches on which she's radically wrong is as low as possible. And that's what this conditionalization policy does. Since there isn't one that does better, then that seems pretty reasonable. Okay, so here's the last step. I've given you a count that, if true, and if not true, I want to know which of the axioms is wrong. If the account is true, then we can learn empirically that chances or branch weights are those given by the Born plot. That doesn't yet tell us that we can confirm Everettian quantum mechanics. We do need an extra step. We need to make sense of the idea that Everettian quantum mechanics is a theory according to which the branch weights in our sense are Born-Wall ones. I have in our sense because the word branch weight has been used in two different ways in this conference, and for my purposes now, the difference is absolutely crucial. I've been using it decision theoretically. I functionally define branch weight using a decision theory. Elsewhere, the word branch weight, the term branch weight has been used in a very different way, namely just to be stipulated as a term that refers to amplitude squared in Everettian quantum mechanics. Those are different. Everettian quantum mechanics is a theory that gives you amplitude squared for branches. We've given you a decision theory that talks about branch weights, and we need to know what the connection is between the two. So here's where I think the Deutsch-Bonnet argument fits into our framework. There seem to be two options for making sense of the idea that a branching theory, like Everettian quantum mechanics, might be a theory according to which the branch weights are such and such. You can derive it, or you can postulate it. Deutsch and Wallace are saying that it can be derived. You might or might not think that works. If it doesn't work, then you have to have Everettian quantum mechanics be a theory that postulates that the branch weights are given by the amplitude squared. And there are reasons to be sort of metaphysically squeamish about this option, but now we're in many worlds and no worse than one territory, because I think you can be squeamish in all of the same ways about the notion of a physical theory postulating chances in a non-Everettian theory. So what's the picture that emerges? I think it's the following. We have a unified account that illuminates the connection between the practical and evidential laws of probabilities. That's nice. It'll be a bit mysterious if one and the same thing perform two different roles that didn't seem to be related to one another. It's an account that applies equally well to indeterministic theories with chances and to branching universe theories with branch weights. It also applies, crucially, to situations like our actual situation, in which we don't know whether or not the world is branched. We don't know whether we're dealing with indeterministic physics or with branching physics, and part of what we're trying to figure out is that is the case. And it turns out to be an account that entails the confirmation theoretic principle that I called CW, the one that tells you what's the confirmation theoretic role of branch weight, in the same way that it entails the principle CC that tells you how chances behave confirmation theoretically. If Everettian quantum mechanics can also be understood via either of the two routes I just sketched, Deutsch-Wallace or otherwise, as a theory according to which the branch weights are given by the Born law, then this is going to have the consequence that our existing empirical evidence, relative frequencies and so forth, confirms Everettian quantum mechanics, just like it confirms any other version of quantum mechanics. And this means that we don't have any reductio ad cum. That's more or less the end, but I want to make a couple of remarks about explanation, because this, I think, is a concern that a lot of people have with the whole approach that I've been taking. It's a concern that I find it quite hard to make contact with, but I want to try and then invite comment. So here's a quote from David Albert's talk. Against the whole, you know, Deutsch, Wallace, Greaves, anyone, all these guys, they're all wrong, they're missing the point, even if what they said was true. It wouldn't get them what they want. Albert says the following thing. Look, it's frequencies and not our betting behaviours which make up the raw data of our experience. And it's those frequencies and not our betting behaviours which primarily and in the first instance stand in need of a scientific explanation. And it's precisely here that the Fishing hypothesis, famously and perennially and by its own admission, falls short. And the thought that one might be able to get away without explaining those frequencies, which is the central thought of the decision theoretic strategy, is when you think about it mad. Okay. Let me say how I want to reply to that. First, some of this is false, like by its own admission. I said it. But never mind that. Let's talk about the rest. Okay. How does the notion of explanation relate to the sort of account that I've been presenting? I've been talking about confirmation. David Albert and others want to think about evidence in terms of this notion of explanation. Well, the notion of explanation is notoriously slippery, but I think we do know some things about it. So everything on this slide, I think, is, yeah, everything on this slide is intended to be things that people who raise explanation related objections, I'm expecting them to agree with it, so if that's not the case, there's your time. I think the following conditional statements have to be true. If relative frequencies confirm accuracy in quantum mechanics, as the account that I've presented entails that they do, then it can't also be that aberrantic quantum mechanics doesn't explain those relative frequencies. Whatever else we know about explanation, things that confirm theory are explained by those theories. So it must rather be that the following thing is true in that case, so subject to this if, then the following thing must follow. Insofar as ascriptions of relatively high probability count as explanatory of the things that they're ascribing probability to, we must also accept that ascriptions of relatively high branch weight count as explanatory of the things that they're ascriptions of branch rate too. But who cares? Okay, this is the thing that the explanation guys probably won't agree with. The point here is, what was our problem? Why were we unsatisfied in the first place with this impoverished version of Everett that just said, here are the branches, here's what's going to happen on each branch, there aren't any probabilities, but I don't care. We were worried because we thought that if that was all our theory said, we wouldn't be justified in believing our theory. If the confirmation theory is true, then we're justified in believing our theory. If, in addition, branch weights aren't explanatory, we don't have to care. We're still justified in believing our theory. That's the thing that we ultimately cared about. So I think it's implausible that branch weights wouldn't count as explanatory, but if they don't, I don't care. All right, here's what you get if you turn this conditional around. If Everettian quantum mechanics doesn't explain relative frequencies, then it must be that relative frequencies don't confirm Everettian quantum mechanics. It's not hard to get that from the thing that I said a minute ago. And in that case, it must be that the confirmation theory that I've offered is false. So the reason I emphasize this is sometimes in David's talk, I got the impression that what he wanted to say is this confirmation theory that you're giving me might be true, but even if true, it's beside the point. You're missing the point. What you need is this thing explanation. That can't be the character of the objection. Say again?
I
don't think that's in the picture. We've just got this situation where we don't know whether the theory is true or not. We've got all this evidence, and we want to know what's the relationship between this evidence and this possible theory that may or may not be true. Okay, so if relative frequencies... if Everettian quantum mechanics doesn't explain relative frequencies, it must be that somehow... the confirmation theory that I've offered is false. And in that case, we want to know more about why it's false, so which axiom is false. And in particular, if there's something wrong with the confirmation theory that I've offered, then we're back to the mess we were in at the start. We don't know what confirmation theory should replace it. So in that case, we're going to want to work out what's the true confirmation theory that goes in its place. So I invite comments on that from anyone who's concerned about some account where explanation plays a central role or placing the logic. Okay, that's all.
Pretty naughty, but I don't mind.
So did I just sort of missed a crucial step at some point? I didn't understand something, so you can probably tell me that. But there was, you were talking about confirmation theory, yes, and there was an example involving coin being flipped 100 times. But in the Everettian context, it's a quantum coin, and I had two. It sounded like we were testing, it could have been testing two different sort of hypotheses, that the state is Psi-1 or Psi-2.
It could have been that, or it could have been two different branching theories, Everettian quantum mechanics and something else.
That's the point I'm confused about. If we are already Everettian and we're testing Psi-1 versus Psi-2, we're doing a lot of measurements and then updating accordingly. I can sort of see an explanation of why we're regarding those relative frequencies as relevant to the question of whether it's Psi-1 or Psi-2. And it must be because we're giving a high caring measure to those branches in which, using this procedure, I come to the right conclusion.
Yeah.
I know that in some branches I come to the wrong conclusion, but just those with the right high caring measure. That's why this is a sort of good
is updating procedures Google to use for my information. But when we're talking about theory choice, we can't be talking about a carrying measure that ever at QM is true.
No. So carrying measure is supposed to be something that just gets distributed across the branches of the main tree. Yes.
In that case, so having felt I understood the coin example in the Everett case,
okay.
Still don't understand how that argument means that a credence in Everett being true can be updated.
So suppose you have the following two hypotheses. Either it's Everetting quantum mechanics and the branch weight of heads is 2/3, or it's GRW and the chance of heads is, what did I say for Everett?
Two-thirds,
okay. Or it's GRW and the chance of heads is 1/3. Then you want the same thing. Now you're talking about, in the Hadoop representation, the alpha lambdas are now chances or branch weights, you don't know which they are. And when you update, you become more confident that the chance or branch weight is 2/3, and that tells you that it's probably Everetting quantum mechanics and not GRW. And this makes sense because you know that if Everetting quantum mechanics is true, then updating this way is going to lead you to the true belief on the majority of branches according to your carrying measure. And if GRW is true, then updating this way is probably going to lead you to the true belief. So regardless of which theory is true, this is a good updating strategy, so it's a good updating strategy.
So you must think it unproblematic that these alphas you don't know.
I do think it's unproblematic.
I'd actually be thinking about that. Thanks.
One's just following on from John's point, and I think one way of looking at it is, it's not exactly that the Everetting would be just, for the Everetting definition problem would be solved if we were granted CW. It's more that it would be solved if we were granted the hybrid that says something like, if theory X puts high weight on such and such, and theory Y puts low, number argument puts low chance on such and such, then...
I might have misstated it.
And you do talk very much about in what sense we regard the exchangeability assumption as reasonable. And one of the things one were conditional on Everett being true prior to one altitude square equals branch weight in your sense, I think we ought to be able to argue using the same sorts of reasoning as one is trying to use in the Deutsche impact strategy, that exchangeability must be rationally compelling in that situation because the exchange situation is physically identical. You know, in both situations we've got what we know the thing we're doing, maybe we achieve it, is definitely in that stage. Whereas in the numb.
So you're thinking of a case where we've got a small number of definite physical theories on the table, we're certain that one of them is true. All of them tells us that some particular sequence of experiments is repeatable. Is that
something like that, yeah. I mean, you could ask what justification for repeatability is. If in a branching theory, again, sort of generalising from quantum mechanics, in a branching theory it becomes rather more problematic to say, do the swap, and modulo sort of labels or might not justify raising, modulo those labels on back in exactly that same physical situation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you knew that much about the small list of physical theories that might conceivably be true, you could probably do something like that. In the framework that we've been trying to push, it's more a situation where ab initio you have absolutely no idea what the true sequence is, and then you tell a story about finding out empirically which sort of sequence of the experiment is responsible.
Could I just get clear on, so there seems to be a worry voiced in discussion that you're ending up with two theories which have identical physics but which have different branch weights, and those would somehow be added on as different views on this view.
Right.
Could you comment on that? I mean, I don't quite understand why one would come to that. It seems to me that one would rather have arrived at a wrong understanding. Because look, how does one know what the Empton squares are? I mean, one's branch weights is going to be one's guess as to what the Empton squares are.
I'm not sure. What do you want me to do?
I don't really understand the worry, and I'd like you to speak.
Okay, I think I understand what the worry is.
Okay,
good. I get that. Okay, so suppose we have this situation where we all agree that by observing relative frequencies, we can find out what the branch rates are. But branch rates here doesn't mean amplitude squared. And suppose we further think that the Deutsch Wallace representation theorem doesn't go through. We're worried about equivalence or something. So then we don't think there's any way you can argue a priori that conditional never-acting quantum mechanics being true, the Kering measure you adopt has to be that given by the Born law. Rather, you think there's a large class of rationally permissible measures over other acting branches that one might choose to adopt as one's Kering measure in the decision theoretic sense. So that's the situation that we're talking about.
I think that I misunderstood you. I thought that what we were arriving at is an empirical procedure by which we're tracking something. Call it what you will, branch weights or tracks, we don't really know what it is. So we've got a well-defined empirical procedure by which we're tracking these things, so far as we are in agreement with those axioms. So let's call it branch weights. Now, whether or not that branch weight that we're tracking and arriving at by virtue of updating the conditional on the statistical evidence that we see, whether or not that quantity actually is numerically quantitative squared will depend on whether, you know, what that evidence has been. We may have, from a relative point of view, we may be on an anomalous branch and we'll arrive at a quantity that actually isn't numerically squared. That's how I thought it was going. But no.
I don't think that's making contact with the worry. Let me finish stating what I take it the worry is supposed to be. So we're in the situation that I described. We think there's a large class of rationally permissible Kering measures. But we also know that in this framework, in order for relative frequency evidence to confirm ever-acting quantum mechanics, it has to make sense to understand ever-acting quantum mechanics as a theory that postulates some branch weights or other. So then it seems that what we're forced to do is to say, okay, we've got a large class of different physical theories here. They all look a bit like ever-acting quantum mechanics, but they're importantly different from one another, and here's how they differ. They agree on the quantum state, and they agree on the Schrodinger equation and all that jazz, but they disagree on what the physical branch weights are. And then that sounds very odd, because it seems you've got a situation where, on the one hand, these theories all agree about the physics, because it's the wave function, they all agree on the wave function, but they postulate different branch weights. And then you might start worrying, oh, so you've got physical theories that are postulating properties that are in some sense normative, since they only figure in decision theory, and what's going on? But that's the worry.
What's the solution? What's the answer to that?
Well, the short answer is many worlds are no worse than one. If you want, you can say all the same things about characters. A slightly longer answer would be, let's try and be deflationary about it.
Could you say the same worry in the non-branching case about chances? Could you say
yeah. So we are taking the principle to be analytic. So we think that the handle that we have, the thing that fixes the meaning of the word chance, is the principle. And then we want physical theories to be the sorts of things that can postulate chances. But this seems very odd, because that means that a physical theory is doing something like postulating that, insofar as you believe such and such to be the physics in the sense of a set of possible histories, your credence distribution over, or, you know, your conditional credence distribution on this set of histories has to be such and such, otherwise you're irrational. And that's odd, because that sounds normative, and physical theories aren't supposed to say something normative.
Okay, well, when you sort of first come across from Kering or Ansel Tentu, I think, from Peters.
I'm sorry, I can't possibly tell you which one of these axioms I disagree with, but your statement that many worlds is no worse than one brings up something for me. If I'm an Everettian and I have my finger on the nuclear trigger and I'm undecided and I've got good reason for pushing it and good reasons for not pushing it, and I don't push it, but I know that I did push it, that I'm better off not being an Everettian and not pushing it.
Sorry, I'm not getting the scenario. You don't push it, but you know that you did push it?
Because I'm an Everettian, and there's a branch in which I did push it.
Okay.
And destroyed the world, no matter what I did. So I'd rather not be an Everettian, because then I could not push the trigger.
Right. Well, whether to press it random. You decide whether to press it on the basis of some quantum measurement.
Preference.
Decision.
You think you have good reason both to destroy the world and not to?
Yeah.
In this scenario? Why?
Yeah.
I mean,
what's the reason I have in this situation to destroy the world? I guess it's
You could be faced with a fail-safe situation where you're not sure if the other side is launched, okay? And it could be that they didn't, but you have a reason to think that they did. And then you could, like, before you knew that, you could be faced with a decision of preemptive, you know, response. So, I mean, it's not hard to come up with an either-or situation which, because of a lack of knowledge about the true situation, is you have to make a decision. But if I'm an Everettian and I push the button, I mean, I don't push the button, then I still believe that there's a branch in which I did push the button, and then there's a branch in which they didn't launch their strike, and I blew up the world inadvertently. But if I am not an Everettian and I don't push the button, and it turns out nobody launched the strike, then nothing happened to that. So if I have a choice of being an Everettian or not being an Everettian, in that case, I'll prefer not to be.
I think this is related to a lot of the worries that he was bringing up as well.
Yeah, it is related.
I don't know. Can I say
something about that? Because I think there might be a misunderstanding of the whole approach behind that. All this talk about decision and preferences might, and tying it up with confirmation and concerns, might give the impression, and I'm not sure if it did, that on this view, we set our degrees of belief in various hypotheses about the world according to which ones we prefer to be true. And that's not the approach at all. You make decisions based on your preferences between the outcomes and your estimates of how likely those outcomes are. But it's not, you know, it's not, you don't adjust your degrees of belief. Which theories I prefer to be true don't come into the scientific
research. Okay, sorry, I'm going to cut that little bit short. Adrian was actually next.
Okay, in 2 weeks, could we go back to the last slide, please? Yeah. And could we realize I wrote a couple of things before you? So, I just want to get straight the logic of what the story is.
It's 3.5 minutes, Adrian.
Right, so they don't have more questions. So here's one proposition. Proposition A says, Everett implies, like, I'm likely to find myself in a group of DNS history. My history is likely to be open in DNS. Proposition B says something like, things will happen. I have a new account of scientific confirmation, and according to my new account of scientific confirmation, if I find my history, then Everett's likely to be true. The argument is, well, if this is a good account of confirmation, then you expect that B ought to imply A. So, and my account of confirmation does support B. Therefore, anybody who's worried about A, you have to tell me what's wrong with my account of confirmation. I don't show you that it's not a good account of confirmation.
So, I'm not sure I know what A means.
Yeah. The only thing that goes wrong is in the presupposition that if it's a good account of confirmation, then that B has to imply A. When we're dealing with branching theories, we know the concept of probability, that it's slippery when we're in branching theories. I think it's a mistake to rely on the intuitive consequences of the familiar confirmation theory rather than the foundations of the confirmation theory in thinking about how things are going to pan out.
Is it possible then that what's actually going on here is there's not only new Everettian sort of kind of probability, a new Everettian kind of confirmation, a new Everettian kind of what it means for one theory to explain another one has to be adding or to be having a story about why Everettian explains confirmation?
I don't know, I certainly want to resist the suggestion that this is an Everettian kind of confirmation because that's obviously going in the direction of the reductio-ad-tunum type worry. It's supposed to be in the kind of confirmation that you get by looking at the axioms we had already and the reasons that we had for applying them in the ways that we did, thinking what similar sorts of reasons we might have in the branch case, Everettian or otherwise, and then just deriving the consequences. And it's not an Everettian account in the sense that it's an account for anyone who has non-zero credence in Everett, not just an account for people who have high degree of belief in Everett or accept Everett or whatever you want to say.
I think it's an important point. Notice that when I set up a little sketch of the Bayesian confirmation, the word explanation did not come in at all. And I actually meant to say this in the talk because both you and David Albert in your talk put a lot of weight on explanation in the role of confirmation. And here's my attitude. If explanation is to play a role in confirmation, I would like to see about the Bayesian rationale for that. So if you can give me a talk kind of explanation so that the more explanatory theories lead to higher likelihood, or that the more explanatory theories have higher priors, then I'll accept a role for explanation in there. But if you're saying, no, I don't just want theories that upon conditionalism on the evidence I have a high degree of belief, in addition, I want explanation, I think what's being confused is reasons for believing something. It is cognitive virtues, reasons to value theories, and reasons to believe them. Right? And we should keep those things separate.
Did you still have a question?
I have a writer writing in a minute and
10 seconds
if they run
out of it.
You asked for. Which of the axioms people might disagree with? It's typical, one usually disagrees with the zero of axiom, flatness of space-time, or something like that. And I think what I disagree with is the axiom that a utility function U that is reasonably stable under time and not terribly context-dependent is consistent with a simple Everettian branching picture.
That wasn't one of the axioms.
I know it wasn't, but that's why I'm saying it's axiom zero. In the ordering and so on, you assume that there is some sort of stable preference that one can describe, that it doesn't depend on whether Schrodinger's cat has fleas the next day, and whether, the fleas then have bacteria and so on.
No. The preference of rooms I was talking about were instantaneous.
Right. Well, I'm saying that an instantaneous preference depends on some sort of belief about the future. And that if probabilities are not stable functions in the future, as it would not be natural to think that they were in a simple discrete branching picture, in the intuitive picture one simply counts branches to get relative frequencies, then the whole sort of stable utility function wouldn't exist. And the fact that we do, in practice, know that we have stable utility functions might suggest that there's something wrong about the picture.
Okay, so if there's an objection to the framework based on the idea of a simple intuitive account of branch counting, then the discussion we need to have before talking about this stuff is why I don't think that simple intuitive account of branch counting is going anywhere.
Hopefully we'll have it tomorrow.